It's 10:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Thousands of Africans head to China each year to buy cell phones, auto parts, and other products they'll import to their home countries through a clandestine global back channel. Hundreds of Paraguayan merchants smuggle computers, electronics, and clothing across the border to Brazil. Scores of laid-off San Franciscans working without any licenses use Twitter to sell home-cooked foods, and dozens of major multinationals sell products through unregistered kiosks and street vendors around the world. When we think of the underground economy, we tend to think of crime, prostitution, gun running, drug trafficking, stuff like that. Well, there's a new book that opens up this underground economy, showing how the worldwide informal economy deals mostly in legal products. It's a it's economic activity worth $10 trillion, making it the second largest economy of the world. The title of the book is Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. We have its author with us, journalist Robert Neuwirth. Robert Neuwirth, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, I mean, it was basically my prior book was about shanty towns and squatter communities in the developing world, and recognizing at that time that squatters were the largest builders of housing in the world. And this was kind of a brand extension, if you will, that I recognized that there was this huge amount of essentially legal trade that was being badmouthed because it's being done in this quasi-legal way. And so I decided to go out there and meet the people who are part of this economic community.
$10 trillion. I mean, that's a trillion to me is still a big number. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, how many zeros? Look, it's a huge amount of money, and what it indicates, what the dollar figure indicates, is that this is hugely important for the entire world, and particularly in the developing world, for the survival of people in those countries. This is how more than half the workers of the world make their living and support their families. So it's a crucially important part of the global economy, but economists and policymakers tend to ignore it or disparage it.
Well, it must be a little difficult to even measure it because it is, after all, underground.
Well, that's absolutely true. Look, $10 trillion is a rough estimate. I've used the numbers that are used by the world's foremost authority on this, a professor in Austria named Friedrich Schneider, who has published a bunch of papers estimating the size of the informal economy using various indicators. But obviously, there's a fudge factor built into this. It could be $10 trillion, could be $8 trillion, could be $15 trillion. We really don't know, but we do know that this is kind of a ballpark figure.
Obviously, there's been a worldwide recession on for several years now, and there are a lot of financial upheaval. Does that tend to create more activity in the informal economy?
Absolutely, absolutely. When there's economic difficulty, people turn to unusual means, or at least means that might at other times be considered more difficult or illegal in order to survive. And that's why you see people who've lost their jobs in the downturn in the U.S. turning to selling street foods without a license. And they may have a license to sell on the street, but if they're preparing the food in their home kitchen, in many states you're not allowed to sell food that you've prepared in your kitchen on the street. So, you know, there are technical ways in which their activity is, quote-unquote, illegal in the municipalities they're in. And people turn to this to survive. It's very common. I expect to see more of it in Europe with the downturn in the euro, certainly in Greece. And this is how people survive in difficult economic times.
You talk about these informal entrepreneurs as being crucial to innovation and things like that. How so?
Sure. Well, for instance, I'll give you an example. There's now a cell phone that's marketed in Africa, which takes two different SIM cards at the same time. So you can be on, let's say, AT&T and T-Mobile or Verizon and T-Mobile at the same time, taking calls and switching between SIM cards without changing phones. And this exists not because someone recognized, hey, let's make this, but because in Africa you need, and in places like Africa in the developing world, there are different systems that are stronger in different parts of the country, and you may need to reach your family or a cousin in a different part of the country with a different system than the one that you're using in the big city. And so you need two SIM cards, and so the African diaspora that has gone to China to get things manufactured brought it up to their Chinese manufacturers and said, look, this is something that we need, and the Chinese responded by manufacturing the phone. So this was a demand and an innovation that was created from below by the very people who use the phone. And that's just a pragmatic example of how the underground economy drives innovation.
Well, let's talk about that connection between Africa and China, because you emphasize that in your book, and it's fascinating. How did this come to be, and how does it operate?
Well, it comes to be because the global multinationals, who manufacture mobile phones and other kinds of high-tech products that people need, but also clothing and toys and everything, they don't see a profit margin worth pursuing in places like Africa. So as a result, the African merchants have had to go out and get things manufactured on their own. China is the manufacturing superpower of our era, and so what has happened is a vast migration of Chinese entrepreneurs, African entrepreneurs have gone to China to get things manufactured and then import it back to their countries. Estimates are that there may be as many as 300,000 Africans living in Guangzhou. Official statistics only cite about 30,000, but most of them have overstayed tourist visas and are no longer counted, so it could be as high as 300,000. And they're there to do business and get things manufactured and import the goods back to Africa where people can buy them. And that's where you find mobile phones and blue jeans and hats and sunglasses and flash drives and everything that we take for granted here in the United States, but that is much harder to find at a price that people can afford in places like Africa. And so that's how it happens.
So these cell phones that are being made, are these like Nokia knockoffs, or what are they?
Well, sometimes they can be just phones created by a Chinese brand, like the dual SIM card phone, which was created by a Chinese manufacturer and has their brand name on it. But there is also a brisk trade in knockoffs. And that can be what the Chinese call Shanzhai, where it'll say Nokia instead of Nokia, or Sony instead of Sony, or Motorola instead of Motorola. But it also can be the straight out, it'll say Nokia on it, it'll look like a Nokia, it'll have all the features of a Nokia, but it won't be a Nokia. It's often manufactured by the very factory that manufactures Nokias for Nokia, and just in the after hours, they manufacture Nokias that are not for Nokia. Those obviously have a lower price, and that's what the African importers are looking for.
You referred to this this underground economy as System D. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've pirated the term from the French-speaking former colonies of France. There's a word in French, débrouillard. If you call someone a débrouillard, they are a self-reliant, ingenious person. And in the former French colonies, they've adapted that word to describe what they call l'économie de la débrouillardise, or the economy of ingenuity and self-reliance. And that's what they call the informal economy. And they refer to it as Système D in French, or System D in English. And basically why I like that term is because it says something very fundamental about what we tend to refer to as the informal or underground economy, which is it's a system. It has existed for thousands of years. It's a distribution channel. Many big businesses use it. And that's why I think it's a much more useful term than just saying the underground or the black market.
Now, you kind of drew a line here in terms of the content of your book at the outright criminals. So you're not talking here in Stealth of Nations about gun running and drugs, human trafficking, things like
sure.
that.
Yeah, I think it's very important to make that distinction. There are things that are outright crimes. I mean, organ harvesting from the poor, or human trafficking, human slavery, gun running. These are things that are creating health hazards. They are abusing people's human rights and causing death around the world. And we have to treat those things and continue to treat those things as what they are, which is crimes. What I'm talking about and what the $10 trillion represents in terms of trade is legal product just dealt with in a quasi-legal way by people who may be avoiding paying taxes or may not have gotten a license for import-export or may in some way be doing business without the knowledge of government. But nonetheless, they're not dealing in criminal products. And I think that's a crucial distinction to make because we need to pursue the drug dealers and gun runners of the world, but we need to recognize that there's this other phenomenon which is much more important and is crucial to the livelihoods of people.
How about the United States? I mentioned at the top of the program San Francisco street vendors.
Yeah.
How is this stealth economy manifested in the United States?
Well, first of all, it's the U.S. has admittedly a very low percentage of its gross domestic product that is dealt with in System D or the informal economy. So whereas Nigeria, it might be two-thirds of the Nigerian GDP is sub rosa. In the United States, it's only between 8 and 9% of our gross domestic product. But given the size of our economy, that makes us the largest informal economy in the world. And out of that $10 trillion, $1 trillion is generated here in the United States. And it's everything from the construction laborers that job up outside of Home Depot and Lowe's to gardening workers or maids or house care workers, home health care workers, all of people who are doing totally legitimate work just for cash only under the table or somehow off the books or without licenses. And it's, you know, even take New Year's as an example. When I go out in New York City to celebrate New Year's and I buy my little horn to blow my horn at midnight, or I buy the 2012 eyeglasses with the flashing LEDs from a street vendor who's charging me a buck or two, is that guy declaring his money? No, most likely not. He's part of the informal economy, too. And so it goes on all around us, and it's manifest everywhere. We just want to forget about it.
We're talking about the new book just out, Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy, with its author, Robert Neuwirth, journalist and author. And you can join us, 800-486-8655, if you have a question about the informal economy or a comment. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and you can leave a comment there. Again, 800-486-8655. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Robert Neuwirth in just a moment. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. 21 minutes after 10 o'clock. Coming up later on the Ideas Network on Chapter Day, Susan Sweeney reads from The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrett. In a Balkan country, a young doctor tries to unravel the mysterious circumstances surrounding her beloved grandfather's death. That's coming up later on Chapter Day. This hour, we're talking about the book Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. We have the author of that book with us, Robert Neuwirth, a journalist and author. And you can be, too, at 800-486-8655. Why do we need to care about this, and particularly why do we need to care about it right now?
Well, two things. First of all, we need to care about it because this is the way the majority of people are surviving. I mean, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a nonprofit that's sponsored by the major capitalist countries of the world, did a study and determined that 50% of the workers of the world are earning their money off the books, and that's going to rise by 2020 to two-thirds of the workers of the world. So this is just, this is the way people are surviving. Number two is that we're going through economic turmoil right now. And when we're going through economic turmoil, we have to recognize that people pursue these non-traditional means of making money because they need to. And we have to recognize that and see how we can work with these people for them to continue to survive and thrive. So I'd say for those two reasons, that's why we have to care about it.
We have callers who want to join us. Let's start in Milwaukee and hear from Victor. Victor, good morning. I can't hear Victor.
Control. How is it enforced and doesn't exist? Because when you buy these products, you're running a risk of poor quality. And what about your reputation? You know, if you got great products, then people will beat a path to your door. But if you're not, you're out of business. So how do they survive?
Well, yeah, Victor, I think we missed the beginning of Victor's comment. He's concerned with quality control. Does it exist? How is it enforced?
Yes.
Victor, it's a really interesting thing. For instance, on the pirated stuff that comes out of China, I was talking with an auto parts dealer in China who sells mostly pirated stuff. I mean, she's got all these brand name products on her shelves, but there's not a genuine one in the mix. They're all fakes. But the high-quality manufacturers of fakes actually offer guarantees. So you can return the products the same way that you could return a product to the actual manufacturer. So in some cases, the pirated goods actually are high quality. In other cases, sure, you're running a risk. But in the same way that if you buy something for cheap somewhere, and it's a brand name that you don't really know, it may be lower quality than the fancier product that costs a lot more, but you buy what you can afford. So to some extent, sure, caveat emptor, buyer beware. But people need things at prices that they can afford, and this kind of production and distribution chain is providing those things. So I think people make their own decisions based on that.
Victor, thanks for the call. You point out that in many parts of the developing world, the informal economy is the only part of the economy that's growing, while mm-hmm. the legal economy sort of has been stagnant. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because there's a tremendous number of people at the bottom of the economic pyramid, and they're where innovation and growth is happening, and they can't afford the products that are produced by the top of the economic pyramid. So it's just the sort of simple massing of where the social classes are. And given that in many of these countries, the formal economy sort of leaves out most of the people, then you've got a dual problem. So I think that's what's driving it. It's just the sheer mass of people who are left out of the formal system.
And I would think that that one of the big differences between informal and formal, you mentioned, you used the term unlicensed, unregulated, untaxed, is that you don't necessarily need a tax lawyer or an accountant to run your business, and you don't have to worry about dealing with bureaucrats and government red tape.
That's certainly true. And look, in many parts of the world, bureaucracy is an enemy. There's a Peruvian economist, Hernando de Soto, who famously documented that at one time in Peru, just to get a simple business license to do the most simple work in Lima would take 235 days, the equivalent amount of money and time of 235 days of work, which is ridiculous. So certainly working sub rosa like this would get rid of that factor. That makes it much more sensible for people who are just starting a business. But that's true here as well. Look, I'm one of the people that I profile in my book is a jewelry designer here in Brooklyn, New York. And she started her business completely off the grid and off the radar for exactly the same reason. She couldn't think of creating it formally and getting a business license before she started. She had to start her business and grow her business in order to then, at this point, several years later, be able to think about getting a license.
What about the view of government in all of this? If these people aren't paying taxes and they're not going through the normal licensing process and so forth, are there efforts to crack down on the informal economy? And obviously, they're not. If there are any, they haven't been very successful.
Well, there are efforts all the time. And look, government hates this, right? And so I would imagine that people involved in national and state and even local governments would probably argue with my thesis in the book, and I'm glad to take that on. It's certainly true that many people in the economic underground don't pay taxes and avoid paying taxes, and that means less revenue for government. But we also have to look at it that taxation is a kind of social contract. And you pay your taxes because you're getting things back. And if the merchants at the lowest end of the spectrum don't feel like they're getting things back because the government's money seems to be going for tax deals for office towers and other kinds of things that just aren't to their benefit, then they're going to feel less allegiance to the government and less concern about avoiding paying taxes. And I guess I should also point out that major economists suggested to me that actually avoiding paying your full share of taxes was common in small businesses in the United States up until the spread of credit cards. Once every transaction became on the books because of the spread of credit cards, then it was impossible not to report that transaction to the federal government. But before that happened, small businesses constantly massaged the amount of money that they reported to the government and paid in taxes because it was normal. And as one economist put it to me, we shouldn't feel that superior to Nigeria because our people did it too. So I think it's a normal thing. And governments, I think, should be working with these merchants to figure out how to have them grow their businesses to the point where they can afford to be able to join the legally recognized portion of the economy, or if they don't want to join, that there are certain licensing fees or other things that they can pay without being forced to pay other kinds of fees for registering their businesses in different ways.
Let's take another phone call. This time, Bob in Madison, you're on the air. Oops, we lost Bob. I think Bob, what Bob wanted to talk about, we mentioned earlier that you kind of drew the line at outright criminal behavior like gun running and drugs and so forth. I think he was asking how you make the distinction between one kind of crime and another. If you're avoiding, if you're doing business and not paying your taxes, which the law requires, or if there's a license required for you to do business and you're not getting it and it's deliberate, how is that crime different from any other crime?
Well, if that's Bob's question, the way I would answer it is, look, we have criminal law and civil law in this country, and we put murderers, I hope, if they're convicted, in prison. And we don't necessarily put a tax cheat in prison, depending. We make distinctions all the time between various types of crime. And I would argue that if you're selling food on the street and the food is safe and people are enjoying the food and you're making money to support your family, that if that's a crime and if society wants to determine that that's a crime, it's a very different kind of crime than engaging in prostitution or selling drugs. It doesn't have the victim in the same way that prostitution and drugs do. So I think we make those distinctions all the time, and I think we have to start looking a bit more creatively at what, in fact, makes this a crime. Why is it a crime to sell something on the street without a license from the municipality saying that you can sell something on the street? Why is it illegal for me to run a business out of my home if I so desire? And if that's what can make me money to survive so that I can go down to the grocery store and buy milk for my family. So I think those are the kinds of questions that we have to ask. But there are different kinds of crime, different categories of crime, and we have to recognize that.
Well, what you're moving on from that, what you're really looking at here as we discuss this is real capitalism at the street level. This isn't people in $4,000 suits trading pieces of paper back and forth. This is actual capital creation and exchange at the most basic and literal level.
That's exactly true. And look, you know, in history, this was the original economy. I mean, there were no rules saying that you had to get permits and all this stuff when trade began. Trade started because a couple of people felt that I have this product and you have that product and we can exchange them. If that was the case, there were no licenses involved. There was no government agent involved. Initially, there weren't even stores. There were just street hawkers. And in fact, this country was built on the backs of street hawkers, the Yankee peddlers who took goods to the frontiersmen and sold them stuff and wandered the country. Sears Roebuck was started by a station agent named Dick Sears, who peddled watches to the people who passed through on the train. Stanley Tools was started by a Pac-Man and Tinker who sold tools from the back of a mule. So this is a grand tradition in capitalism and the development of capitalism, and I'm just saying that it's still here and that we should be acknowledging it and enabling it to grow.
There are lines available for you if you'd like to call now. A couple just opened up. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number you can use to call in, make a comment, ask a question. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org. You can also reach us via Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page and leave a comment there. Let's go next to Linksville. And Michael is on the line with us. Michael,
yes,
good morning.
Yeah, the economy's here, and it's all here because of cheap fossil fuels. So, but my real question is should the future of the ability for, with the advent of the digital era, should the future of the ability of governments to track money, especially as we were just talking, like they can now through card usage and such, would that be a future for the elimination of cash, whether that be coin or paper, in the sense that the government then can have full control? Because should, obviously, there be more calamity in the future, the Amish have a very robust system for commerce, and the rest of the country could ensue such a system. So my question is, you know, is that something that anybody even talks about, or is it just you know, people like me who kind of worry about it because the world's changing with zeros and ones?
Well, that's absolutely true, and certainly, we're moving more and more towards a cashless society. That's definitely true. And there are pros and cons to that. On the one hand, it's very useful on the nefarious scale of the criminal spectrum. It's very useful to be able to track money exchanges around the world and figure out how terrorists fund themselves, for instance. But on the other hand, do we want every single piece of our money tracked all the time? Is that an invasion of privacy? So these are difficult questions, but there are alternatives to currency through barter systems, through community currencies that may be pegged to the dollar but may be independent of the dollar, designed to keep money circulating locally, so that there are sort of resistances to this, which I think will grow over time as people recognize that they need more community systems to survive and support themselves in difficult economic times.
Do you include the barter economy in your book?
I don't go through it in the book because it's a very different setup than just straight out, you know, paying for product and import and export. But I do feel that it has the potential to be a different kind of economic system, and that if I certainly feel that people working within the informal arena could tap into barter networks in order to further their distribution. So I do think that it's connected, but not exactly the same.
Michael, thanks for your call. Let's go to Viola next and talk to David. David, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for the conversation. You kind of covered what I called about, but my follow-on question to the fact or the observation that this is really the ultimate in self-regulating economies is what kind of back communications exist back to, for example, the manufacturers of these knockoffs products? And I'll listen on the air. Thanks.
I wasn't quite sure what he was saying about communications back to the product, to the manufacturers.
Oh, in other words, if I'm not satisfied with something, how do I get that dissatisfaction back to the manufacturer?
I understand. Okay. Well, basically, if we take the example of Africa, what happens is that, you know, the end user on the streets of, let's say, Lagos, Nigeria, will communicate to my friend David Ibekwe, who deals in auto parts, and tell him, this is a substandard product, and he will go back to his manufacturers and say, you can't give me this anymore. So it's indirect from the end user, but very direct from the importer, who goes direct to the factory and has a one-on-one with the manufacturer right there. And similarly, for the mobile phones, the people that I knew were dealing directly with the factories and could go to them and say, look, you know, 90% of these phones had a problem, so you have to change that and give me better phones next time.
David, thanks thanks for calling. Rodney in Milwaukee, you're next. Rodney, go ahead.
Hello, yes. We were talking about when you're saying that a lot of our businesses at the time were small business, you know, or people just off the street. Mm-hmm. And companies like Sears or even Ford, when they finally became big businesses, they would go to the government and say, let's regulate this so small businesses wouldn't compete with them.
Sure.
They do that all the time. So it's not like politicians or average citizens will go and say, regulate this. And so every time that something has changed to make it harder for a small business person, it wasn't done by some government, some guy saying, hey, I just want to hurt small businesses. It was always a big business is saying, hey, I want to monopolize this business now. This is a law I want to be put in to help that. And until we can get those big businesses out of our government system to say, hey, we want to change the rules, because whatever big company don't want to be like AT&T, they don't want to be competed against and stuff like that from smaller vendors.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Look, the big businesses, one could argue, and certainly many of the informal merchants that I've dealt with argue this, that big business engages in essentially a protection racket by going to government and getting these rules and regulations put in place to prevent others from entering the marketplace. And that's definitely true. The interesting flip side of that is that big businesses in certain arenas also make use of the informal economy. And the example I'll give you, and I describe it in the book, is consumer goods companies like Procter & Gamble. Now, Procter & Gamble, a huge company, does the bulk of its business as a single customer with Walmart, all right? It sells the bulk of its goods to Walmart. But as the biggest market share of its business, it sells the bulk of its goods to tiny stores in the developing world, most of which don't have licenses and are doing business without the knowledge of government and probably not paying taxes. So Procter & Gamble sells its goods to middlemen who sell to the small businesses that deal in this product. And so a major portion of Procter & Gamble's revenue, perhaps 20% of its revenue, comes from this kind of source. So Procter & Gamble makes use of the informal economy when it needs to, but I suppose also marches on government to prevent competitors from coming up, as in the point you made.
Rodney, thanks for the call. We're going to take a quick break and come back. We have a lot more people who want to join the discussion, and line will be opening up soon for you if you'd like to call 800-486-8255. 8655. If you get a busy signal, send us an email. talk@wpr.org is the email address, or post something on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page, and we'll share it from there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 10:43, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest this hour is Robert Neuwirth, journalist and author, whose latest book is titled Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. And by an informal economy, we're talking about something that's worth about $10 trillion a year. And if it were a country, it would be the second largest economy in the world after only the United States. So this is a huge, huge deal. And we've been learning all sorts of interesting things about it this hour, and I'm sure quite a bit more to come. We have a lot of phone calls to get to, so let's go right back to the phones. And Sheboygan next. And John, good morning.
Hello. Earlier caller stole my thunder regarding my ideas about competition and regulation. So if I may take a different tact, I'd like to point out that there's also an underground economy of information that I think that I'm a consumer of. I've stopped watching television. I get most of my information from alternative news sources online. And I think, you know, most of the media outlets, in fact, everything you read, everything you watch on TV, everything you hear on the radio, for the most part, owned by a handful of media outlet companies. And, you know, those of us who consume, alternative media sources know that, you know, there's this concerted effort by the government in cooperation with companies to, you know, limit the Internet. It was illustrated a few years ago with the Net Neutrality Act that they're trying to push through. So I'd like to hear your guests' comments on this.
Well, I do think that it's there is an informal or underground nature to the Internet. It's been going on for a while, and I would say that attempts to regulate the Internet are misguided, in the same way that I'm saying attempts to stamp the informal economy out of existence are misguided. The Internet is a tremendous tool for free speech and has a lot of potential for giving more news and more access to people. So I do think that there's a great similarity to it, and I would be against any effort to regulate it or force people out of existence on the Internet. That being said, just something in favor of the mainstream media is that, you know, newspapers like your local paper in your hometown or the New York Times in my town, these newspapers are sort of like trusted sources, if you will. You know their biases, you know where they're coming from, but you know also that they're not in the business of saying something that isn't vetted in some way. And, you know, there's a lot of information out there on the Internet that may or may not be true. And so it is useful to have a sort of established media that at least creates a consensual zone where we can trust what they're reporting, and that it's not innuendo with nothing backing it up. So I'd say that in favor of some of the media companies that are out there.
John, thanks for the call. Mark in Richland Center, you're up next. Mark, good morning. Thanks
good
for joining
morning.
Us.
I really want to thank you for this program, and I wanted to go back to this business of alternative currencies, because your guest spoke about how the entrepreneurial side of the economy early on was about barter and just about the initiation of a good idea and then taking that into being. And so the idea is that the doing is the real deal, and whatever you use for money in order to clear the trades is almost irrelevant. And so it's in an economy that understands that doing is the money, something like a time bank, which is used, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, Dane County has the world's largest time bank, longest standing, where labor exchanges are done on the basis of the doers have credit and nobody else has earned a thing, and you have to actually do something. Then if you look at something like openmoney.org, that takes you into this whole business of credit clearing in a formal way, and many, many, many different kinds of currencies actually exist. The problem we have right now is that our currency limits us to using the system imposed on us, but that carries with it a huge amount of debt, such that somebody like Ellen Brown and Steven Zarlenga in Chicago and others have pointed out that virtually half of what we could be doing is what we are doing, because we're limited right now with all of the imposition on our system by way of using debt as money instead of using the doing as money. So these alternative currencies really carry a lot of weight in terms of the strength of an economy and the strength of a local community when you start getting it, that the doing is the real money. So the underground economy is basically just an example of saying that the monetary system that we're currently using doesn't work, so let's use something that does. And Zarlenga has pointed out that all throughout history, when money fails to perform that function that it's supposed to, people just start abandoning it. And that's why we have the black market like we do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, I'm certainly in agreement with that. And I think that the alternate currencies and the alternative currencies are a hugely fruitful avenue for people looking for a more creative way to use their labor and to use their time. And, you know, the time bank is a very valid way of measuring worth.
Well, what this puts me in mind of in some respects is if you take a look at the 11th, 12th century Europe, the merchant caravans, which went all the way, they traveled all the way from Moorish Spain all the way to Russia. And they had goods that they would swap along the way. And it wasn't about currency. There was probably some gold or silver or jewels involved, items of value that are recognized everywhere, but they were taking goods from one place and swapping them for goods in another. The cloth of Flanders for the furs of Kiev or something like that.
Sure, I mean that's definitely that's the origin of some of this stuff. But look, you know, the flip side of the currency problem is that some countries don't have strong currency, and they don't necessarily have the export goods, except for raw materials, which have to be done in bulk, to do the kind of swapping that the ancient caravans engaged in. And so there is some way that we need the national currency system just to be able to facilitate a kind of level of global trade. And again, I'll use Nigeria as an example. The Nigerian merchants have the Nigerian naira is not a world traded currency. So if they're going to go to China, they have to change their naira into dollars. And they have to bring dollars to China and then change their dollars into Chinese yuan. And so they need a kind of stable currency exchange rate system to be able to make the deals that they're making, because they can't carry boatloads of raw materials to barter with the Chinese factory that they're doing business with. So there is a need for national currencies and for some means of exchange of national currencies. And that's not going to be replaced anytime soon by time banks or alternative currencies or even bartering.
We have an email from John in Milwaukee who asks, do strict patent laws that we have in this country have any bearing on this?
Well, they do. I'm not an expert in patent law. But certainly they give individual rights to inventors. And sometimes the inventions are very tiny. So the guy who invented the slide lock on the plastic bag can license his tiny little invention that changed the Ziploc to a slide lock, and he will get very wealthy because there's a lot of money in slide lock freezer bags. That certainly adds to the price, but you could argue on the other side of it that it spurs innovation because the inventor can actually monetize his, he can gain from his invention without having it immediately ripped off. I guess I would say that it adds to it, but in global terms, it's much more difficult to hold on to that. For instance, the reason why certain products are pirated in the developing world is they're just too expensive here. You know, if a Nokia phone were cheaper in Africa, people would buy the legitimate Nokias, but they're pirated because they're just too expensive for the average African consumer to buy.
Thanks for that email, John. Let's take a call from Bob in Madison next. Bob, good morning.
Good morning, John. And yeah, my question for Robert: how widespread is the underground or unregulated street trade in this country? And given our economic downturn, would you expect it to become more widespread here?
Well, I do expect it to become more widespread, and it is spread uniformly across the country. Again, as I said earlier, it's about 8 to 9% of our gross domestic product, which, given the size of our economy here, makes it about $1 trillion worth of economic activity. Much construction labor is handled informally with cash under the table to guys who job up in front of Home Depot and Lowe's. And it's just at various places all around the country. In rural areas, it's people working a second job from home that they don't report their income on. In urban areas, it may be people selling food on the street. So it's hugely important, and I do expect it to grow. And even as we make – perhaps we'll make modest steps towards recovery, I still think it's going to grow because I think people are recognizing that it's hugely important to run these businesses and have more security in their lives.
One of the things I found most interesting that you write about is that there are actually street vendor-specific brands.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And you find them, for instance, in Nigeria, UAC Foods, which is a formal corporation traded on the Nigerian stock market, was founded when the British controlled Nigeria, creates a sausage roll called Gala, which you won't find in any stores. It's only sold by hawkers on the street. None of their other products are sold by hawkers. So they've determined that this one sausage roll, that's their distribution network, that they can do better selling it to motorists at street corners and in traffic jams than they can selling it in stores.
As you were putting this book together, what was the biggest surprise you ran into when you were out amongst these street vendors and talking to people? What was the thing that surprised you the most?
Well, there were a couple of things. The first was that even guys who were doing massive markets, that were running in all these countries that I went to, and that was Brazil, Paraguay, China, and Nigeria, people still felt that they were discriminated against by society. Even some of the merchants who were tremendously successful and had retailing awards from major manufacturers like Sony and Panasonic were still feeling like they were black sheep or something like that. And I found that very strange. And personally, for me, I started out this process being a more traditional, focused on legitimate stores and legitimate businesses, and I found myself becoming more anarchist and libertarian as I moved around the world, having some sympathy to the argument that often government gets in the way of progress rather than helping it. So for me, that was a really eye-opening change. I had never expected that.
What do you, based on your research and all the people you've talked to, where is this informal economy headed? Is there going to be some kind of major confrontation between the informal and the formal economy, or government stepping in, that kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. I think the informal economy will continue to grow. I think it's dependent on the sort of flaws and fissures right now in the governmental system. And so it's opportunistic and not revolutionary in that sense. Now, on the other hand, I do think that there are opportunities for the informal merchants to create cooperative networks and to put to work alternative currencies or time banks to look at organizing themselves for more power. And if they can start doing that, then there are some avenues for either working with government or coming into conflict with government. But I don't see that happening in any massive worldwide conflagration of labor violence or something like that. I think it will happen gradually.
Well, we're going to leave it there. A great place to stop. Robert Neuwirth, thanks for joining me this morning.
Yeah, John, thanks so much for having me.
Robert Neuwirth, journalist and author of Stealth of Nations, The Global Rise of the Informal Economy. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour of programming. Chrissy Pease and Katie Mattson handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network at Wisconsin Public Radio.